You're listening to Writers on Writing, a show about the art, craft, and business of writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Alexander Sammartino. Alex was born in Rhode Island, grew up in Arizona, and now lives in Brooklyn. He received his MFA from Syracuse University. His debut novel, Last Acts, was published by Scribner in January and was selected as the New York Times Editor's Choice. Last Acts has been described as hilarious and wrenching by the Minneapolis Star Tribune, irreverent by the Chicago Review of Books, and a wholly American novel about salvation by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Alex has been called magnificent sentence writer by the New York Times Book Review. On the show, we talked about father and son novels, short chapters, multiple perspectives, beginnings and endings, interiority, backstory, influences, and much more. And now for my talk with Alex Sammartino, author of Last Acts. Alex, I'm so happy to talk to you about Last Acts. And before we get into the book, if you would, talk about how you found your way to writing.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Barbara. Truly an honor. My path to writing was a little delayed and strange. I didn't grow up wanting to be a writer. I loved reading when I was young. And then I kind of became fixated on other things. And when I was in my second semester of college, I had just moved home with my parents. I was going to Glendale Community College at the West Valley in Phoenix. And I had this incredible professor. It was just kind of like an intro to American literature class. And we read Faulkner, and we read A Rose for Emily specifically, which is kind of a pulpier story in the Faulkner realm. And so it was really, for someone who maybe like wasn't as refined from a literary perspective, it gave me another way in. And I became obsessed with Faulkner, and I could barely understand what I was reading when I would read him at that point. But I read As I Lay Dying and Sound and Fury and Absalom. And I think, you know, that was kind of my beginning as a reader, really, as an adult. And that same semester, I had a public speaking class that I took, and the professor was a spoken word poet. And he asked, as the final assignment, everyone in the class had to either write and perform their own poem or perform a spoken word poem. And I wrote one. And I remember sitting in my house with my roommates. We were all bouncers at a bar together, and I was reading them this poem, and I was like, this is incredible. I love this. This is so amazing. But I had no real kind of sense of what it took to be a writer then. And I ended up after a year going to Syracuse University, and I met the writer Dana Spiotta, who became my mentor, taught me everything I knew. And she was the one who really kind of put me on the path to being a writer, in that really explained what it took, which was showing up every day and participating, trying to write and trying to engage with the text, and taking these things really, really seriously. And, you know, she was the first kind of real artist I ever knew. And she just had a tremendous influence on my life. And so I think that's kind of what put me on the path to writing from there. I knew at that point, like, this is what I want to do. And I can see a method to do it. And I'm going to just take this thing as far as I can.
Did you start with short stories, or did you go straight to the novel?
I always had an impulse toward novels, because that was what I, and still love reading. And I kind of think on that sense of a broader canvas. I did write short stories because I was always in creative writing workshops. And that's kind of like, I feel the standard is you bring a short story, and that's what's assessed. So I was trying to kind of fit into story mode for many years. I went to graduate school, got my MFA, so I was kind of writing short stories then, and they're all really bad. And I knew I wanted to try a novel, and I was, reluctant to take the leap. And then it was just a matter of, once I felt I had something that I can't, because it's like being in a really long relationship, right? Like you have to spend years and years and years with something, some image or sentence or character. And so I think once I kind of latched on to certain ideas, that was when I started trying to like write a novel. And I definitely had many tries before Last Acts, but with this one, it really felt like from the beginning, I had a relationship, the father-son relationship, which I'd kind of set out to write. And that felt like it, what bound everything together was that sense of a family living at what they fear to be the end of the world. And that was kind of what I wanted to stick with.
Well, talk about Last Acts, and how it came about. I mean, like, how did you know that you wanted to stick with it? What came to you? Was there like an image, a sentence, a character, a situation?
Yeah. So there was a sentence, and I ended up cutting it from the book. I was trying to write like a kind of, like I said, a father-son story, but I kept drifting off and writing about these heroin addicts who are trying to make a reality show to become famous. And I was like, what is going on here? And why do I keep drifting off this way? So there was that idea, and I was trying to figure out what the connection was and how to put them together. But then we were talking about typewriters. So I actually started using a typewriter in the fall of 2019. I was having a lot of trouble writing and just like deleting everything I wrote. I would write and I'd just be like throwing that out. And what I liked about a typewriter was it forced me to kind of maintain forward motion and at the same time to slow down tremendously and to take account for each letter. I wrote maybe 100 pages on a typewriter and then I threw them all away. But I knew by that point I had something that was going to be Last X. And I was like, I just need to kind of get more text in front of me, being able to kind of scroll through it all faster. I couldn't kind of maintain that sense of a novel shape with the printed out typewritten pages. So I think that was kind of a big change in my method that helped me when I went back to a word processor work much more slowly. But yeah, it did kind of start out with a simple sentence and an idea for a relationship. And then when I felt myself going off the rails, it was rather than trying to kind of stop myself from going there, it was like, what's the connection? That's what something I learned that Dana told me is like, you have these different ideas that can seem like they should be two separate projects, but often there's a way and they actually want to be one of the same. And I think that's kind of, the book is divided into two like major sections. It has that sort of symmetry. And I think that was kind of built in from the very beginning when I was having these kind of strange wanderings mentally.
So when you say you threw away the pages, did you actually physically throw them away, or did you just start
I
over?
have them. I have them, but I don't. Not, I will never show them to anyone, and that's just because I'm a hoarder and I keep everything I've ever. I mean, my wife wants to kill me because I just have sheets and sheets and sheets, but they're all tucked away in my little office. But yeah, I did keep them. I never. I'm honestly scared to look at them because of how bad they must be. And so, I also was driving everyone insane in my apartment building because it was really loud. I never kind of really got the sense of how loud the electric typewriter was. And I would write in the mornings before I went to work. So it was really early. And it was this kind of, it was a really, it helped me kind of find my way back into writing at a time when I was really stuck and struggling. It was like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I have what it takes. And I think we often overlook like the mechanics of writing and how important it is to kind of make a change when you're feeling stuck. I've tried writing longhand before. My handwriting's horrible, and I also don't have the kind of spiritual fortitude that requires to really like your hand hurts when you do that for a long time. So, but I think it's the same sort of idea. Like you slow down, you start experiencing the language differently. And if I ever, when I do find myself in that place again where I feel really stuck, I know I'm going to try to, I still have my typewriter, like make the move and go back and try to use that as a way to kind of jolt me and get me going again.
What kind of typewriter do you have?
It's an Olivia. I think that's the name of it,
Olivetti?
right? Olivetti, sorry, Olivetti. Yes, my mom got it for me at an estate sale, and she knew I was looking for one, and got it for me and sent it out. It's electric, really simple, and works great. I've replaced the ribbon, but yeah, it's something I've wanted to get more into, but I can see myself using that as now an excuse to like not be writing, to be fiddling with a typewriter. So it's kind of that balance. Like I have to wait until I know I'm kind of in need of really switching up my process. And right now everything's going okay writing wise. So I don't want to, I'm like very superstitious. I don't want to mess with anything. Yeah. So it's like I'm not going to make a change on how I'm writing until I need to.
Yeah. Well, last acts, we don't see many father-son novels. You see a lot of sister novels. I've seen so many sister novels come through the pipeline or come down the pipeline, and mother-daughter, father-son, you don't see much. Were there
Yeah.
any that you used as, I don't know, inspiration, or were there any father-son novels that inspired you in any way? I mean, I can't really think of, I think one Tobias Wolff or Geoffrey Wolff novel or memoir I'm thinking of, but other than that, I can think of memoirs, but I can't think of novels that are
Yeah.
directly about a father-son relationship.
Yeah, I know I'm gonna, the second we get off this, think of something and hate myself for it, but nothing comes to mind either. There, the mother-daughter kind of novel type is one that I really love. And just, I love the idea of like these generations that are in communication with each other and that love each other, but that are kind of struggling to communicate with each other. And especially when the parent is a little flawed and the child is a little flawed or very flawed. There's a novel by Christine Scott, whom I love, called Florida. And that's a mother-daughter novel that's really, it's like a coming of age tale. That's also, you see this artist go from a child to being an adult and her relationship with her mother throughout. And it's just unbelievably beautiful. And so that's kind of like the kind of like great example, I think, of the genre being done. But yeah, with a father son, I especially in like the literary way, it doesn't stand out. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but that was part of what really attracted it to me, or attracted me to it, was seeing this as an opportunity. It was always something I kind of like danced around in my fiction, that I initially started exploring when I started writing, but then kind of moved away from, and so I wanted to go back to it. And again, I felt like it was something rich, and it was something, the emotional stakes were really, really high. Everybody has a father, and a lot of people have complicated relationships with their father. And to me, like getting to explore that within the context of this, crumbling empire just felt really rich and where kind of my heart was at the time.
And also with Phoenix, the setting is
Yeah.
Phoenix, Arizona. Again, I cannot think of a novel set in Phoenix. And I'm always drawn to fiction that's based in the desert, some desert,
Yeah.
whether it's Arizona, Utah, California. Talk about that, the setting of Phoenix.
So this was huge for me, and there are two books that I think are really great desert novels that often, and Phoenix novels specifically, that don't, there's so much else going on in the novels that it's often kind of missed. They're not like exclusively there. Angels by Dennis Johnson, his first book, like the first half is a road trip novel, but the second half is exclusively located within the kind of greater Phoenix area. And He's also written poems. His first book of poems, Incognito Lounge, kind of takes place in that area as well. And that, to me, when I read that book for the first time, it was just kind of a, like lightning kind of hitting me. Like, there's something strange about seeing something that's so familiar. I lived there for many li years. My parents lived there. And seeing it represented in such a literary and poetic way was just kind of really captivating. I was really reluctant to try to write about it. Oh, and before I skip ahead, I should just say the other book I was thinking of is Underworld by Don DeLillo. There's a lot of Phoenix in that book where, Nick is a waste management executive and is kind of retired there. That's where his life is kind of concluding. But I was kind of reluctant, and I've told other people this as well, to take it on as a subject because it just felt like it was changing so much so quickly. And it was so big, and I didn't want to write like just a desert novel. I wanted it to be very specific and to feel very Arizona. And the more I thought about Phoenix and the more I thought about writing about it, the more I felt like it was this kind of great proxy, this great kind of microcosm for the country itself, and that all of these things were happening there at such a fast rate. And it was a challenge. It was something I was scared of, but it was something that, as a result, I kind of wanted to go toward and just try to explore. And now I'm at a point, my second book is also primarily set here in Phoenix, so I'm like, I got to try to move away from it a little bit. But yeah, it's definitely it's a fascinating place. It's, we're not supposed to be there. It's a desert, but like all of the civilization has flourished around it. And it's this place that, being a kind of a border state, the politics are so complicated and there's so much kind of constant questioning about who is an American and what it means to be an American as a result. And I think, being near in Phoenix, near Indian reservations, right? Like the land is very old and there are people who've been there for a very long time. So you have all of these types of America coming together in a way, kind of mass consumerism, very aggressive consumerism. So it felt like a really kind of rich place for a lot of the things I was interested in. They probably came from living there, but I didn't realize that, until much later. And then I was like, oh, I'm finding this stuff here now in my fiction. Let me try to explore. Let me double down on that.
You reminded me when you mentioned DeLillo's novel and his character, his protagonist named Nick, and your son in your novel is Nick. And when you named your the son in your novel Nick, were you thinking of that Nick too?
I wasn't. I was actually a little scared when I noticed the similarity because I wasn't thinking of it. I really liked the variations on Nicholas. So at the end of the book, in the last chapter, Rizzo kind of moves through all the variations and it's like Nicholas, Nick, Nico. And I always loved that, like, that name contained all these kind of variations. It felt like a good Italian boy name. So that was kind of really where it, came from for me. But yeah, DeLillo, as always, kind of beat me there. So
Well, I wanted to ask you, and I want you to read in a little bit. I would love to hear you read from Last Acts, but I wanted to ask you about like writing fiction set in Phoenix in a real place. How beholden are you to using real places in the book? Or, do you mix up, real places with fictional places? I mean, what's your view on that?
yeah, I love that question. And nobody's asked me about this yet. So it's the latter. To me, it's like you use some real places, but you'll often dislocate them and won't be held to exact geographic specificity. Like, I didn't want it to be like Dublin for Joyce, where every single detail had to be like mapped out because we live in a very different world now. And, these things obviously change very quickly. Phoenix itself changes very quickly, but also like you want to be able to have fun and establish a sense of reality, but then also establish that this is a fictional reality. So I want to use some real names, but maybe in some real places, but move them around the valley so they're not exactly where they appear, put them next to things that aren't really there. So it has like the spirit of the place, but it's clearly existing within a fictional plane. To me, that's like one of the ways, really early and really clearly to kind of assert that this is fiction, right? Like this is going to be something that's very embedded in reality, but is very much fiction.
My cat just wandered in case anybody's hearing a
Oh,
meow.
mine's over here. Don't worry. She was trying to eat my computer cable while you were asking me a question before.
Well, so the gun thing, there guns play a major role in this book. I mean, it's very much, it's Rizzo's business that then Nick comes into. And how did that come about?
Yeah, I think this was also one of those things that was really something I hadn't explored in my fiction before, but it was something very normalized for me. I think, especially being in Arizona, like there's a very kind of standard gun culture. And I'm not originally from there. So I was born in Rhode Island. And when I was a kid, we moved. And I remember being, oh, your cat's adorable. I remember being at first very aware of it and then becoming very numb to it and then leaving and going back east. Now I live in New York. It's a very strange thing, I think, especially to New Yorkers to have these objects be normalized in that way. And they are. And there were kind of, I guess, two big things that interested me about guns and that I knew I wanted to explore for the book. I knew I wanted to write about some sort of mass shooting because I just felt like that personally is such an anxiety of mine and is for so many other people. And it's something that feels so contemporary, such a new existential threat for us. And so I felt like I had to explore that. And then secondly, the kind of consumer presentation of guns, the fact that these are objects that are sold to us, that really interested me as well. So those were kind of the two things that brought me into the book, intellectually, why I wanted to write about guns. I think, yeah, being in Arizona, it was just, again, something very, and for vast parts of the country, right? This is very normal. And so it feels like it's such a, one of those things that I didn't kind of think about as strange until I left. And then I was like, oh man, I'd like to kind of interrogate this a little bit and consider more about our relationship to these objects and to this culture. And again, going back to the idea of like Americanness, like a defining idea of being a patriot is, owning a gun. And I was really struck in the way that that opposed the way we view drugs. So the idea that like by using drugs you're, and this view is changing, but the idea that by using drugs you're, like not, I'm trying to think of the right word, but you're somewhat of a, you're viewed as a degenerate, right? The by having this object that's not sold everywhere, right? But by buying a gun, you're a patriot. I was really interested in that tension, the way we treat people differently, who are in recovery versus who have guns. Like, I think there's an argument you could say that if you want to buy a gun, maybe you should be in some sort of therapy, right? And if you want to do heroin, maybe you're actually extremely logical because, yeah, most of us want to be in oblivion most of the time, being alive right now. So I think I just wanted to mess around with those ideas. They felt really fun and really American and really specific to Arizona.
And then there is an almost tragedy, right? There's an almost tragedy where that puts the father, Rizzo, in jail because he sold a gun to someone who used the gun that almost committed the tragedy. So talk about that and how that came about. And was that a surprise for you, or do you plot? Do you outline? Did you know this was coming and how you were going to deal with it?
I again, I had the like intention of wanting to write about a mass shooting, but not I don't plot, I don't outline, I just kind of go. I try to work from the ground up. And when I was writing really bad fiction, I was working from the top down and being like, here's my idea and I want to realize it on the page. And instead, I know I'm talking about all these ideas I have and they're always in the background, but I try to just really focus on like, what is the language doing? What are the sentences in front of me? Build the sentences up, think about how they come together on a local level, and then also on the paragraph and the chapter and the entire book. But as I was writing this, I kept kind of thinking about like, what are the consequences of selling guns? And to me, it felt like one of the most terrifying consequences would be, giving a gun to a mass shooter. And originally, when I first wrote the book, I had it be a shooting that was very Sandy Hook-like. And Sandy Hook was just one of those things, I think, for a lot of people, where it just feels so evil that it's incomprehensible. And I don't have anything intelligent to say besides it brings me tremendous, tremendous sadness. And I felt like it would be really kind of provocative to have to consider the characters who were in some way related to that. And I think my editor and I talked about it, and there wasn't like at the time enough kind of about the shooting in the book, because I really wanted to be about this father and son. So it was like, okay, well, what if it's a near tragedy? What would that mean? And that's when the idea of like a mass survival came out for me. And I was like, oh man, there's a lot of stuff I can do here that doesn't kind of have that incomprehensible evil that something like Sandy Hook does, where I can't even fathom, going on from that. And so it was something that was certainly on my mind. The way of the how it was going to be executed, I didn't know. And it was kind of just a matter of writing it, trying things, revising it. And it's become really interesting to me. A friend actually sent me an article that I believe was in the New York Times about survivors of the Kansas City mass shooting after the Super Bowl, and that they formed like a mass survivor foundation for those people. And I think you look at the Crumbly case in Michigan, where the parents who gave the kid the gun have been convicted. That's the first time that this has happened in to my knowledge, in kind of the history of American mass shootings. And so I think we're, as a culture, starting to kind of expand our sense of like responsibility, our sense of culpability. And that was something I wanted to explore with Rizzo, was here's this kind of wayward, hapless salesman who's will do anything, will hawk anything to make a buck. And it's like, well, what if you hawk the wrong thing to the wrong person? Like, what's the consequence of that?
Wow. Where did Rizzo come from?
I think he's like a composite of a lot of men in my life that I love. There's like a lot of my father in him for sure. There's a lot of me in him. I think like people usually assume that this is just a book about my dad, but it's a book about a lot of men that I've known and that I've loved and that have been really important to me. And because I'm a narcissist, it's also, about myself too. And he felt like a character. I think I really always identify with the underdog, the loser. I always feel drawn to that. I remember watching that Clint Eastwood movie that Sofia Ford Coppola remade, Beguiled, where Clint Eastwood in the original is taken into this house, whatever. I read an interview with him, and he said about the movie that he didn't like the script at first because the character was a loser and he could never play a loser because he's a winner. And I remember being like, wow, I'm the exact opposite. I could only ever play losers. I only identify with that. That to me feels what's so real. And then so it was like, okay, I wanted RZA to come out with that, come out of that, but I didn't want him to just be one-dimensionally like a sad, sappy sort of person. I wanted it to be someone that you could take seriously, that you could laugh at, because I think fiction has the ability to kind of like have those complex emotional responses that like movies and other art forms don't necessarily have, where someone can be really seen from so many different perspectives and felt, and even at the same kind of point in time, be both comic and tragic. And I think that to me just felt very true, and what it felt like to be a kind of, doomfully ambitious person. Like, I think I really just identified with that.
Doomfully ambitious. That's good. He also reminded me of some of my relatives, you know. And as you were talking, I was thinking about Italian fiction, which, you know, it's like, where are all the Italian characters, right?
No, that was really, I mean, again, that's coming back to, this being a book about, Rizzo, specifically being about people I love. Like, I come from a very Italian family, and it was fascinating to me to think about, and I've talked to Dana a lot about this as well, 'cause she's Italian, but just our, like, the relationship to language that Italian Americans have. It's really physical, it's really animated, it's always kind of refracted. And to me, that's like a writer's dream, is having access to that register all the time. So it's like, okay, this is not only who I am, but this is artistically really compelling and fun. Like, I want to explore this more. And it's certainly something that I haven't seen as much. There's, again, going back to Underworld, there's that section, Arrangement in Gray and Black, that takes place in the Bronx in, I want to say, the late 50s, it's set. And it basically reads like Dubliners, but for the Bronx, right? Where it's all these Italian Americans, and they're talking about blood pudding, and just there's all these little great phrases. And that's kind of one of the few instances, besides going back to like Christ in Concrete and those kind of far off Italian Americans, that I can think of. So it's like, it's a huge part of my aesthetic. It's like what I am continuing to write about. And it's also, I'm trying to be self-aware in the same way I am with Phoenix, where it's like, I don't want to overdo that. And but it is really a part of who I am, who my family is, and kind of how I think about the world.
I'd love to hear you read from last act. Will you please?
Absolutely. And I'll just read from like the first couple pages for
Okay.
us. This is from the very opening of the book. Saved, yes. David Rizzo knew his son's resurrection had saved his gun shop. The arrival of this fact, abrupt, vivid, brought him to silent tears behind the wheel of his unreliable Eldorado. He drove through the depthless desert sky, wiping his face, the world a smear of bare earth and sunlight. Rizzo's firearms rescued, his son not dead. It settled between his stomach and his throat, this stark revelation. As Rizzo drove to the hospital on that heat-sick afternoon to pick up his son, drove fast across the tall loop of the freeway, over the lifeless suburbs, Sonora Gateway, Arroyo Foothills, Moon Valley Manors, above the carnival spreads of outdoor shopping centers, Desert Ridge, Scottsdale Quarter, Metro Center, past the pockets of turf fields, car dealerships, adobe churches, drive-through liquor stores, uncharmed apartments, as he drove on beside the midday glitter of the casino talking stick, across boundless land streaked with posing saguaros, then the barbed purple columns of the East Valley Mountains, superstition, toward the minor glass of downtown. Yes, as Rizzo drove through his home of Phoenix, Arizona, he began to embed all the angles of his elaborate salvation. All his life, he had waited for a sign from above. Here it was, his estranged son, back for a reason. It had been more than a year since he had last seen the kid. And of all days, this one, when Rizzo was supposed to sign the shop away, the call came. Overdosed 3 days ago, he said, flatlined. Nicholas, on the phone with that familiar mumble, meek and sorry. It was obvious. If his son could return from the dead, so could Rizzo's business. Now, in the clay-colored valley of the desert, all was glory, all was light, all burned with the eternal grace of the divine. The Eldorado's engine was smoking. Rizzo, distressed, parked in what seemed like the only open spot at Banner Health, his shit engine. Outside the car, he paced around, afraid the whole thing might catch fire. Seared the shit out of his fingers when he tried to lift the hood. He twisted his pinky ring, patted the gray curls at the back of his head, hoping the coils of smoke would suddenly quit. They did not. After walking a mile to the Circle K for some coolant, a lonelier journey than Rizzo anticipated, he leaned through the dust knocked into the air, the one man on the roadside, and the sound of every truck bed rattling past made him feel as if he was somehow left behind. Rizzo got back to the hospital just in time to watch his Eldorado be loaded onto a tow truck. How could he have missed the sign that said those spots were reserved for medical vehicles? Rizzo, dumbstruck, sweated through his silk shirt, still hugging the container of coolant, unsure of how to spare his Cadillac the sad ordeal of the tow yard. You see that last night? Six dead, 14 injured, sorority girls, deputy, cyclists, the tow truck guy said, tearing several identical pieces of paper from a clipboard. He was a man of frail build and dense beard. Makes you wonder, some maniac in a car, mind gone, shooting everyone. You never know. Right here, right now, could be us. Except this kid hated women or something and wanted to kill them all. But hey, you never know. We could be women. It could have been us. Random, everything, right? The tow truck guy, socially pondering a recent massacre, meant the vehicle was safe, or so Rizzo thought. But then a button was pressed and the car rose with a groan to the flatbed. Of course, this was not a big deal in the grand scheme. Calmly, Rizzo, inside the hospital, introduced himself to the first floor receptionist, who sent him to the second floor receptionist, who held up a finger while she called the first floor receptionist before unloading Rizzo on Maria, a lisping medical assistant who, phone pinned between shoulder and ear, steered a stretcher through the packed hall. Unforgivable, totally unforgivable, Maria said to her phone.
Before we bring Alex back on, a few words about Patreon. Patreon is a way to help Marie and me to bring the show to you. If you've gleaned anything at all from the show that's helped you along your writing path, please consider becoming a patron. Visit Patreon page at patreon.com/writersonwriting. Buying your books at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting also helps us and indie bookstores. On our page, you'll find books by authors who've been on the show, as well as books Marie and I recommend. And now, more with Alex Sammartino.
The beginning is so strong. You know, we always want first pages and first chapters to be the strongest ever,
yep.
Right? Talk about the beginning for you. Was this always the beginning?
Yes, I am obsessed with the beginning of novels. I won't read a book if I'll give someone like a couple paragraphs. My tolerance is very, very low. To me, if like if you can't pull that off, I can't trust you to do anything else later in the book. You know, you can't get my attention anymore. And I Mary Carr told me that Philip Roth used to incessantly revise the first 100 pages. That's all. He would just do 100 pages, 100 pages, and he would spend so much time just tinkering those, and he felt like everything else would follow if he got the first 100 pages right. And I found that to be a really helpful way to just kind of break the novel into something more manageable, and then you keep moving the yardstick, right? So it's like, okay, what about the first 50 pages? What about the first 25? What about the first 10? What about the first five? And then it comes down to, what about that first word? And to me, like, that's the way I read, or I think that about that a lot, like the way I am as a reader, how that influences what I want as a writer. And I want something to just kind of like take off and rip from the very beginning and to really kind of pull me in. And it's very kind of you to say that. Thank you, because it was very, very important for me to get that right.
Well, what about the ending then? And I noticed that the ending sort of met the beginning because the El
Yep.
Dorado shows up again, and you know the ending is strong as well. And so, what's your relationship with the ending? Are you revising that endlessly too?
I am. I'm just a freak. That's what this is really about, is I'm a neurotic mess and I'm always revising and changing things. But I will say, out of all of the revisions that I've done, the beginning was always the beginning. the ending was always the ending. It always ended on the word home. It always opened on the word saved. And those were the two most important. I felt like once I had those things, that was kind of like the, I could figure out what came between those two. But that was so important to me. And part of what I really worked on as I was revising the book was kind of building up from that beginning and the what's established toward that ending. And that's true even formally. So the last chapter of the book is told all in dialogue, unattributed dialogue. And Nick and Rizzo throughout the book, as they're having these kind of like, short exchanges, there's less and less narration between them. It's moving to just kind of a more accessible and free-flowing communication. And even when at the end of the book in that last chapter, things are quite horrible for them in a lot of ways, but they're finally able to really talk to each other. And it's hopefully not as neat as I'm making it sound, but I wanted there to be a kind of formal change as well. So even though they're I don't want to entirely give away the ending, even though I don't believe in spoilers, but
I don't
it
think.
comes back. Yeah, it comes back to the beginning, right? They're in the hospital, but it looks different and it feels different, I hope, I think.
And then there's a short script sort of in the middle. Talk about that, and how did that find its way in?
Oh, so that was also something that it was just way longer early on, and I had to like tighten it up a lot, and there was a lot more happening with it. It was kind of all over the place and messy, so I had to really kind of get it under control and rein it in. But I said this the other night, one of my friends who's a great writer, Alexandra Chang, when she read the book, she was like, I hated Nick until that moment, until the script, because you see him kind of come undone. You really feel for him. And to me, it was a way to both just kind of like provide some formal energy by making a change from the standard narration to a kind of script where you're like, oh, what's going on here? But then to also kind of develop the character again through what's ultimately isolated language. So like I was talking about this the other night with some friends, but I love poetry and I love reading the scripts of plays. I'm not a playwright, I don't have that talent, but I love reading scripts because I feel like you get the essence of what you want your work to do. And so as a fiction writer, it's like, where can I make use of that? Where can I try to Where's a moment where I can push a character through this kind of like formal trial? And so that felt like everything for Rizzo and Nick for the business is coming down to how they execute that ad and Nick's inability to kind of do it that way. And formally, it's obviously very indebted to Beckett and Crap's Last Tape is one of my favorite pieces of art of all time. It just kills me every time I read it. And so I wanted to see if I could, kind of learn from that and apply it to these characters and see how they responded under, there's that, again, going back to the idea of failure, there's so much repetition in failure. And so throughout the script, I wanted to feel repetitive without being repetitive. So that was one of the things I had to work on a lot when I'm revising. So for those who haven't read the book, he's trying to do this ad, running through this script, and continues to mess it up. And so I didn't want to have him, the reader, to keep reading the same bit of text every time. So getting that right was tricky, but it was so much fun. And I really, really loved it. I'm not like a, yeah, I'm not a playwright, not a screenwriter, but just love being able to kind of like put a character in those conditions.
What about the years? I think it starts in 2014 and jumps to 2017. And what prompted that?
Really, the election and Trump. I just felt like I didn't want the book to be reduced to Trump. I thought that would have been the easy way out. And so I felt like by starting in 2014, it was a reminder that like these things that we're really worried about did not just start in 2016. They started looking different, and a lot of other horrible shit started happening. But like this has been going on. And I felt like by having it both ways, 2014, allowed me, especially with Nick in his section, it opens up in 2017 and his customers are speaking differently about guns at that point than they were in 2014. And so there's definitely changes in the rhetoric, but in the kind of fascination with the objects themselves and the kind of American values they represent and the mass shootings, that's been going on for a while. And so I wanted to make sure I could both, it felt impossible for me to not write about like a post 16, 2016 America, but also it felt like an easy way out to only have a post 2016 America in the book.
Interesting. So the book is lean, which I tend to really love leaner novels as opposed to huge novels. Because I mean, I love like Underworld, I loved it, but it's like 800 pages and it's
It's a long book.
really a long time. And then you don't have time to read other things. And so I really appreciated the size. At the same time, you write interiority really well. And it's you balance it well with scene. And sometimes books, I think, can drown in sort of narrative and interiority that goes on, and you want it to end, you want to skim. So talk about that. Like, how did you do that? And did you cut a lot?
Yeah, my process is one where I write a lot and then cut a lot. And so the book was always short, and then it just kept getting shorter and shorter the more I revised. And I wanted to, my favorite novel is like a poet's novel where it's like just under 200 pages and it's really perceptive. And there's not like a ton of plot, but it still moves really fast. And so I wanted to have that kind of poet's mentality of like, do not waste a syllable, do not waste a word. It's unfair to a reader, especially living in the information age. George Saunders, who's one of my teachers, is kind of the master of cutting things and whittling things. But what he doesn't say this explicitly, but what I've always kind of taken from him, I think, is like, you have to have a sense of urgency. You have to, never think like you can just sit back and relax and be like, oh, let me light this fire and get real comfy before the story starts. Like, no, you have to be in fifth gear all the time. That's how I feel at least. And so for me, it's my next book is also really short. It's actually a little shorter than this. And I'm somewhat self-conscious about it because I'm like, man, I want to be able to write a big book and have something to say. But I'm also like, I said this, I was at a reading in Arizona, and I do feel this way. And this isn't just me trying to, defend my aesthetic, but it's like, it feels very easy because of the mechanics of writing to write something very long now, right? Like, because of a word processor, because of the software that's available to write. Like, anyone with a little bit of discipline and a lot of Adderall can write a lot very quickly. And so the challenge becomes, how can I slow down and leave things out and be really selective about how things are coming together and being able to see the entire shape. And I think I'm hoping what will happen is I'll start to be able to sustain this sort of pace for longer throughout my career. But I'm very, very opposed to like writing a novel of a certain length because that's what I think a novel should be. I think that's a crime. I think that should be criminal. It's like your paper, you're against the environment if you're doing that, right? Like, Jesus. So I thank you for saying that. It means a lot. And yeah, it's a form that I love as well. And I think the possibilities for a writer, you can take a lot more risks formally because you're not requesting so much time from people. And I think like that's also something that's very freeing.
How many manuscript pages was it?
In my Word doc, like initially,
Or maybe what you turned in, what became the book?
it was probably around 250. So I cut, I mean, but the thing about my process is it's not so much I start with 1,000 pages and whittle it down to like 200. It's that like I'll start with 250, whittle it to 200, bring it back to 250, whittle it to 200, and then keep doing that. But what I'm cutting every time is a little bit different, right? So I'm seeing something that like, oh, this new thing I wrote is going to stay, and this old thing I thought I needed is going to go. And so I could never just kind of work linearly and just being like, okay, now it's time to cut. I'm not going to add anything. It's like a constant process of doing both. And a lot of my process is just rereading. That's one of the ways I've slowed down, even with kind of being back in a Word doc, just kind of sitting with the text. It's really the nice thing I think about having a novel, being a novelist, is like you have a lot more to read. So you can spend a lot more time, writing, but really rereading and thinking about where you'd want to move stuff around or where you need to cut and where you need to add things. So it's like a really, it's I hope I'm not seeming like I'm just blowing smoke. It's harder for me to explain because it's like I'm trying to do both at the same time, and I'm not, it's never one or the other.
I get that. I get that for sure. I'm wondering though, like in your rereading, will you just open up the manuscript or go to a certain spot in the Word doc and start reading there? Will you read chronologically from start to finish, or will you read like the last chapter next to the last chapter, the three chapters? I mean, just like mix it up. How will you do that?
So in an ideal world, and this is something I learned from Dana, this is how she taught me to write, is like you start from the beginning. You read from the beginning every day. That's where you need to go. So like today, I'm doing edits on my second book. I read the entire book today. That was really fun. It's a short book. You can't, if you write a long book, you can't do that.
Yeah.
But I try to start at the beginning and to get really comfortable with that. And then once I can make it past like the first 20 pages without wanting to kind of tear it up completely, then it's like, okay, I'll move to the next 20. But then I can't get too far ahead without going back to the beginning. I think like the biggest mistake I made as a writer early is writing without looking back. And so I'd be like, okay, I feel good about these 50 pages. I'm not going to look at them anymore. I'm only going to keep looking at these next 50. And it's like, no, because you have to understand how they're coming together, how the sentences are coming together, how the paragraphs are coming together. And again, that's so it's changing kind of where I'm starting the rereading process. In an ideal world, if I was a faster reader, I would start at the beginning every day, and go from there.
Do you do anything to, help your brain not see the same thing, like change the font, make it bigger, make it smaller? Because our brain, it just seems like the longer you look at the same stuff, you just keep missing stuff. I keep missing stuff. It's like,
Oh
oh,
yeah.
I noticed, you know?
It's you feel that way. I felt that way going through like for copy edits and finding typos and being like, I'm just tremendously ashamed. I was like, you mean I've had this typo in here for years and I haven't seen it and I've looked at this thing every day? Like how am I a person? But what I try to do, and again, this goes back to the like mechanics of it, is just change where I'm writing. So my wife and I, she had a closet office at the front of our house, and I had a kind of, we have like a railroad, I think that's what it's called, the apartment style. And so I was in the center, and I would write in there, and I'd write in bed, and I'd sometimes write on the couch, and sometimes I'd go in the dining room. And kind of doing that helped me. I feel when I talk about this stuff that it's very like woo woo and it's
No.
like everybody's different, whatever works for you, but I feel like moving physically helped me a lot. I do have to keep it the same kind of font wise because I feel like I'll start to kind of doubt the language based on how I'm seeing it or have questions based on kind of I've heard of people who will do things like zoom in on the text a lot or zoom out on the text a lot. So they like it's usually as a way to kind of keep them from tinkering with things too much as they're going. But for me, it's like I want to do that tinkering, and that's part of the process. So it's just moving around to different spaces in the house is how I try to do that. Now I've switched offices. Now I'm at the front office when my wife got my office.
Do you read aloud?
Oh yeah, I read everything aloud. I've read that entire Last Acts aloud. Sound is really important when I'm stuck in line editing. It's a way for me to kind of judge whether or not something is working, and it's a kind of like a North Star that I can go back to when I feel lost. It's like my favorite poets, my favorite writers, they they have a really strong sense of sound and of sonics. And so I always want to be aware of that. And it's like always kind of reminding myself where I feel lost. And I'm like, is this doing what I want it to do? It's like, well, what does it sound like? And then once I do that, not that it's easy and that I immediately know what to do from there, but it starts to kind of like push me in the right direction a little bit.
What about the title, Last Acts? When did you have the title?
So I got really lucky with this, because I am horrible with titles, absolutely horrible with them. I never get them right. And the one time I met Dennis Johnson, I heard him read at Cornell in 2016, and he was reading from The Largesse of the Sea Maiden, that title story, which had been in the New Yorker. And before he even started reading, he said, I had the title before I had the story. And I was like, that's bullshit. Like that's she's no story. And I still love his work. I love that story, but I was like, there's no way that's true. And that is kind of what happened with this book, is I had the title very early and I was like, oh man, I really like this. Like, I'm just gonna keep, I don't know how it adds up yet. I'm not sure, but like there's something really powerful about this sequence, this two word, two syllable. I like the sound. Like, I'm going to keep this. And then it was like that idea of the being at the end of the world and kind of this sustained finality. Like that was what really, those things that you do at the end when the end keeps continuing. That's kind of what I realized. I don't know if I really had all of that when I came to the title, but it kind of, I just got super lucky and stumbled into it.
And the cover photo is great.
Oh, isn't it? I was so happy. They gave me five options and I saw that one and I was like, that's the book. Like
Yeah.
that's it right there. That's perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect. Wow. So, before we have a few more minutes, and I wondered if you would talk about your influences or novels and writers that have influenced you.
Yeah, I'd love to.
You mentioned DeLillo with Underworld and Phoenix, but I don't know.
DeLillo is a huge influence for me. I think he's the greatest American novelist. I think they're just, I reviewed The Silence. I love everything he's done. I go back to his work all the time when I feel like this thing is hopeless and I'm like, why are we doing this? It's like I go and I read DeLillo and I'm like, okay, I remember why we're all in this business. So he's huge influence. Dennis Johnson's a huge influence. Dana Spiota, not only because she was my teacher, but because I really believe she is one of the greatest living writers that we have. Her work has had a tremendous influence. And that's partly because I view her work as being a model of how you are influenced by DeLillo and go on to do your own thing. Because I feel like that's what Dana has done. And so for me, I think like every writer, I have a lot of anxiety about my influences. And early in my career, I was telling some friends yesterday that I was like, oh, I can't go toward a certain subject matter if someone I really admired has already been there. And that felt kind of, when I started thinking about it, kind of ridiculous. Like, am I not supposed to write about childhood? Am I not supposed to write about, that's crazy. I'm not supposed to write about death, like that's crazy. And so the challenge then became, okay, you have to go toward those things that you love, but you have to do it differently and you have to do it better. And that takes a lot of hubris to tell yourself that. But I think Dana has done that in her work of like moving beyond that kind of DeLillo type of thing. And that gave me the sense that like, oh, this is, you can go on and do your own thing while also having been influenced by someone who's that of that stature. Christine Scott is a huge influence because her line level work is so big. And her and Dana both came out of that Gordon Lish workshop. And I think all of those Lish writers have had a huge influence on me because Diane Williams, Ben Marcus, Gary L. Lutz, just because of how they think about the sentence, right? It's like it's all about the sentence for them. George Saunders has a huge influence for me because he's so funny. I think he's probably one of our funniest writers that we have. And I'm talking exclusively about writing influences, but there are also a lot of, movies and paintings and stuff. But I think from a writing perspective, Beckett, I would also say, huge influence. And again, it's like he was so big for me, and I really hated his work when I first encountered him because I was so resistant to the idea of embracing and kind of interrogating a certain kind of cynicism or misanthropy. That's how I felt my whole life. So I was like, I can't see that on the page. You're not supposed to feel that way. There's something wrong with it. And I was like, well, wait a minute. Like, what? How do you live with that? And how do you make sense of reality with that? And then I went back to Beckett a lot for that. And my cat's name is Godot. I proposed to my wife before a production of Waiting for Godot at Lincoln Center. So Beckett looms very large in my life. And obviously, I talked about Faulkner like as my way to kind of into everything. And I think again, like he fits with what I'm describing as a sort of like language first type of writer. And to me, that's what is so fun about being a writer. Like I always kind of envy painters and visual artists who kind of work on sculptures because it's like they get covered in their material, you know, like they do a day of work and they have it on their body. And like that's how I want to, it sounds really ridiculous and pretentious, but like that's how I want to feel about language, like where I'm in it and I'm living with it. And that's all of those writers I mentioned. I think that's how I feel when I read their work. And so I think I've really tried to like embrace being influenced by people because that's, it feels really special. Like that's what made me want to be a writer in the first place, was reading, you know, people like Faulkner and just feeling so seen and just being in love. Like, you know, that's something really magical. And that's like, that to me is, what we do matters so much to us and matters so little to everyone else. And so it's like sharing what we do with other writers, you know, it just feels really special. And you know, I feel grateful every single day that I get to do this. I just feel very, very grateful for that professor I had who let me read Faulkner.
And we circle back to the beginning
Yep.
we were talking about. Before we go, I wonder if you have any tips or words of wisdom for the writers listening.
I mean, the best advice I ever got, and I won't say who gave this to me, but his advice was just keep going, never stop. And you never know how good you'll be if you just keep going. And I think to me, like this is a very tough. It's so like at odds with the way we live now. There's no instant gratification in being a novelist. There's not in any form of writing. There's no gratification, let alone instant gratification, right? But it's so special, and the only way you lose this is by stopping. Like as long as you get up and you write, you're a writer, and nothing else matters. And I think that's I have to remind myself of that when I feel horrible about what I tried to write in a given day. But I think just showing up, that's what you do.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Been great, thank you. That was Alex Sammartino, author of Last Acts. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen, and a huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who help make this show possible. I have a Substack page called Pen on Fire, where I talk about writing and do interviews with authors and agents, many of whom have been on the show. Thank you to Travis Barrett for your music and sound editing. And if you like the music you hear on the show, you can find more typewriter music on Spotify under the artist Just My Type. Travis also has original music on Spotify under his name, Travis Barrett. You can access our archive of shows, thousands by now, at writersonwriting.com. And if you want to get in touch, please email us at writersonwritingpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach Travis Barrett at travisbarrettcreative@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. And in the meantime, stay in the chair.